Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The coronavirus pandemic has dominated our lives over the past 3 months. During that time, we've gone from winter to spring. Even though temperatures have stayed cool and maybe cold until just recently, it's a time when many people plant gardens, flowers, trees, or even new grass. This year, with so many people at home during the pandemic, more people have taken up gardening to pass the time because they had more time or they wanted to grow their own food. Every spring, we produce a Smart Talk program to answer your questions or just to discuss your plant life. This year, we're a little late, but here we are. Joining us is Erica Jo Schaefer, landscape designer and consultant with Black Landscape Center in Mechanicsburg. Erica Jo, good to hear from you today.
Oh, so nice to hear from you, Scott. It's lovely to be on the program.
If you have a question or comment, and we are counting on your questions and comments, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Erica, you know, one thing I just mentioned that we're a little late. Usually we do this in late April or early May, almost certainly before Mother's Day. Are we too late this year? I mean, we have a lot to talk about, but is it too late in the season to be talking about certain plants or certain flowers we should be planting?
No. Gosh, we're right on schedule here for a lot of vegetables can still be planted. I just planted my own cucumber and squash seeds yesterday. So there's still plenty of summer left, and because of the late frost and the cold snaps we had, I think people that jumped the gun and got in there too early ended up having to replant stuff anyways.
Well, you know, and I think I have to think that one of the reasons that being a little bit later in the season this year is because the weather was so cold up until about 2 weeks ago. I mean, post Mother's Day, we actually had a freeze. I mean, I don't know how many people I talked to that talked about losing some cucumbers or losing some other plants because of the freeze.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was definitely widespread. And then, of course, the garden centers, we had all of our tender things that we had to cover. You know, somebody, a homeowner having to plant, you know, having to cover three cucumbers wasn't the same as covering tables and tables of, you know, things that we were worried were going to not make through the night. So it's definitely been a thing. And it's coupled with the idea that people really wanted to plant vegetables this year. And then we had the cold temperatures that people who planted too early had to rebuy those. It really has caused the shortage, you know, for vegetable plants.
Hey, Erica, things are a little bit different than when we normally do this in the studio. We're having to do everything by phone. We have a really bad phone connection right here. How about we hang up and we give you a call back?
Okay.
All right, let's do that because, I can, you know, I get to hear this in my headphones where it sounds, you know, all but perfect. And so I can only imagine that it's a little bit difficult for you to hear with that phone connection. Hopefully we get a better one when we do call Erica back. But in the meantime, it does give you an opportunity to call in if you'd like to. It's 1-800-729-7532, and that is the number to call. She's back on the line, I understand. Erica, you there?
I moved to another location here. Walked away from where I was, so hopefully this is better.
Okay. It's not great, but I think it's a little bit better.
Yeah, out here in the...
somebody told me to move your chin away from the phone a little bit.
Okay, how's that?
That's a little bit better.
All right.
Yeah. See, we all have to adapt during this pandemic. It's a little bit different.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Indeed.
So what are some of the trends that you are seeing during this pandemic? I mean, I imagine that there are some things that are new this year that we haven't seen in past years.
Well, I think the biggest thing that has happened is the absolute surge for people to buy vegetable plants and learn how to grow their own food.
So if you're ordering seeds or picking up seeds, the seeds, like I waited myself 5 weeks to get some seeds that I wanted after I ordered because the companies were just not, they were just overwhelmed. And then the growers weren't ready to, you know, sell this many tomato plants. So again, there's shortages all over the place on this stuff.
Yeah, I saw now just one seed company, but I think it's the biggest in the country, Burpee, based out of Bucks County, that this year, in the past 2 months, they've sold twice as many seeds as they have compared to April and May of last year. So that's just a good indication of so many people that are buying seeds. I mean, there wasn't a shortage or anything. It was just that demand was so high, right?
Yeah, right. So they couldn't pack the seeds fast enough. And you know, in our industry, we kind of flow with certain numbers. Like we expect to sell a certain number of cucumber seed packets or a certain number of flats of tomato plants or, you know, a certain number of Christmas trees every year. So there's kind of a known figure that we run with. So when it surges so much like that, it really can be very challenging to figure out, you know, where to get the supply. Did somebody grow enough and pack enough? And is there enough people to meet the demand? But really, it really sped everything up in our industry.
You know, I'm curious, do most people, when they garden, and especially when you're talking about vegetable gardens, do they grow from seed or do they buy something that has already been started?
It can be either way. Most people, I don't want to say most people. A lot of people are afraid to start from seed. I found that the younger generation, our new gardeners, were more apt to start from seed. You know, the more mature gardeners, like me, I wanted a tomato plant right away, and even I started seed pushing them out because I didn't know if when it came time to get tomato plants, if there was going to be enough tomato plants, or if I could even leave my house to go get the tomato plants. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that fueled a lot of seed growing.
And when you, most people who had seeds, did they start indoors with in containers or did they wait to go outside to plant their seeds?
Yeah, I think for the most part, mostly everybody was starting inside, and it posed its own challenges because you shouldn't have started your cucumber seeds 6 weeks ago. So there was a lot of misinformation I saw on Facebook and in other places where people weren't necessarily going to be successful, which is what my biggest hope is through this whole thing, is that people who are vegetable gardening for the first time are successful so that they continue to be gardeners then instead of thinking that they're failures, which really meant they got the wrong information.
Okay, well, what kind of misinformation did you see on social media, on Facebook you mentioned?
Well, a lot of it
people
was
doing
starting
wrong.
Yeah, a lot of it was just starting seeds with a long time. Again, like your cucumber seed, I just planted my cucumber seeds in my garden straight up yesterday. I didn't start them inside the house. If somebody just started their tomato seeds that way, though, they'll be lucky to get any tomatoes. So there's a timing that is involved with all this. And also, the people who did start from plants and bought them, you know, that first week of May and then the frost came along, they lost cucumbers, squashes, tomatoes, peppers, zucchinis, like most of what they would have planted would have ended up dying because they didn't know to cover them. None of us realized there was going to be a frost that late. But if you don't have those extra details, then you think your thumb is not green when really it was a lack of information.
You know, this is different. Our conversation is different in a lot of ways. But, you know, think back over the years when we've had these conversations. At the very beginning of the show, I mean, our conversations have dominated talking about vegetable gardens, and that's not usually the case.
No.
I mean,
no.
That says something right there. I mean, mm-hmm. There are people, and, you know, people have taken a term that they used during World War II of planting victory gardens during this pandemic. And so, you know, it's just so different, the conversation we're having, that we're talking so much about vegetable gardens and people growing food rather than their flowers, their plants, their trees, their lawns, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying how different it is.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, vegetable gardening is so much more of a practical type of a gardening, whereas, you know, the flower garden is, you know, purely for aesthetics and pollinators, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. in, you know, the idea that you can grow your own food whenever this fear-based pandemic thing continues to move forward, you know that you've got food. You know that you'll be able to, hopefully, you know, if you've done a good job with your garden. And so the next thing will be the people who are learning how to use canners and freeze vegetables and make things so that they've got food through the winter. You know, so it's just, it really has opened up a huge portal for people to connect to the land and connect to their food, which I really think is awesome.
We have a question here, a first question from Diana, who says, I no longer bother planting string beans because of the groundhogs. I have my vegetable garden triple fenced with chicken wire, but it still ends up being a buffet for rabbits, birds, and who knows what else. Help! Exclamation point. What can she do?
Well, I'm wondering if she's got three layers of chicken wire, how the rabbits are still getting in. So she should make sure that she's got that chicken wire, Diane, she, as if you can't hear me talking, you know, to use what's called a sod staple and actually pin the chicken wire down so that they can't come underneath of it. Because if you've got that much chicken wire, the only way they're getting in is to come underneath to get to it. So I would absolutely suggest that. And chicken wire is kind of, it stretches and it can move a little bit. If you look for more of a sturdier fence, you know, hardware fence or something like that, you'll find that that will be a sturdier and more of a barrier than the chicken wire would be. But definitely pin it down. I pin mine maybe every 3 feet to make sure that nothing can come under.
So, yeah, it's funny how, you know, those animals find the only vulnerable spot when you have something like that. You would think that with the triple chicken wire that nothing would get in there. It's almost like barbed wire on a World War II battlefield, but rabbits or something else find their way through.
You know why? Because they have nothing else to do for 24 hours a day but look for food and how to get to it.
I thought you were going to say they have nothing else to do during this pandemic. But, yeah, I guess it's nothing new for them.
Yeah, it's like squirrels with a squirrel-proof feeder. There's nothing else to do all day long but figure it out.
Yeah. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Erica Jo Schaefer, landscape designer and consultant with Black Landscape Center in Mechanicsburg, answering your gardening questions. And we know there are a lot more of you out there, maybe even some novices this year. Hey, no question is out of bounds here. I mean, even if it's a simple one like, how do I dig the dirt? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send us an email. Yeah, Erica will get it. smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Erica, we have another question about the critters out there. We have an ant problem in our backyard. Do ants eat ornamental plants, or are they just crawling on them and not damaging them?
Ants aren't that destructive to plants at all, actually, and especially if she's referring to peonies. Peonies and a flower bud is super sticky, so the ants are attracted to that stickiness, and, you know, it is believed that they help the flowers open. I don't know if that's fully true. And they're not harming the peony at all. It's a friendship. So
ants, a friendship.
Ants, yeah, exactly. Ants aren't after your plants. So, no. They must have sandy or soil or some sort of soil that supports the growth of ants.
Okay, so ants may not be after our peonies. And by the way, I wouldn't recognize a peony plant without ants on it, you know?
It's sad because then people put down ant killer around their peonies thinking that the ants are harming the peonies, and it's not at all that. They're friends.
They're using
the poison. Yeah, there's just no need to do that.
Okay, but at the same time, roses, I just noticed in some yards that the rose bushes are starting to bloom. But upon closer inspection, I also see that there are some holes in the leaves. What's causing that?
Well, there could be a couple things. Actually, the slug population is pretty high this year because of the amount of moisture that we've had. I don't use any chemicals on my roses, like at all. There's unless you're going to enter a rose show with your roses, having a few leaves with holes or a few leaves with spots is not something to go running to chemicals about. And if you have those things and it starts to be a larger problem, it usually is the sign of a weak plant. So instead of running for chemicals, like look and see how deep is your mulch. Ask yourself when's the last time you fertilized it. Ask yourself if it's in 6 hours of sun or more. Because a rose that is growing healthy is not going to have issues. It's just not. There's the American Rose Society also rates roses from 0 to 10, with 10 being the best. So if you're hanging with roses that are rated under 7, that means they're weaker roses that are going to be more subject to those insects and diseases. So there is, okay. You know, within that system of roses as well.
When you say your mulch too deep, what's ideal?
2 inches. 2 inches. And it should look like a low bowl, not a volcano, and that includes your trees. Your tree mulch ring should never look like a volcano with a tree coming out of the top.
How do people get into those kind of habits? Because you often see that, not just with roses, but with trees.
I hate to throw the landscapers under a bus, and certainly it's not all of them. And a lot of, especially in commercial buildings, that's what they think it's supposed to look like. And the landscapers, they go dump their wheelbarrow of mulch, and then they make a nice cone. And that does so much damage to trees. Like, the tree roots have to come up into that mulch to get some moisture, and they end up circling and can strangle the tree. But a mulch ring should ever only be 2 inches deep around the base of the tree, and then flare out and could be 3 inches deep around the outer circle of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Tina in Wellsville. Tina, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment. I have 2 5-year-old Siberian Huskies, and their job is to keep the critters outside of the garden fence. We have a fence around our garden. Some part of it's raised bed, part of it is rototilled. And we put up a fence because I can't let the dogs in that area, because if I touch something, I guess they get jealous and they dig it out and they chew it up and carry it around. they do keep the critters away from the garden area, and then the fence keeps the dogs from carrying my plants around.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tina, you gotta make some trade-offs here. You understand, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, throw them a carrot every
now and again. This system seems to work. It keeps the critters away, and then the fence keeps them out of the inside where the plants are. So it works for me.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call. Erica, I know you're a cat person. Do your cats guard your garden?
Oh, the things they've been doing, I can't even. They're murderous. They're bringing bowls and rabbits to my back door. I've not ever experienced this little rabbit damage in my garden. Luckily, I've not seen a single bird come to my back door, though. So anybody who's about to spaz about that, like, the bowls and the moles and the chipmunks seem to be their favorite thing.
I've seen a lot of chipmunks this year. Hey, we have another question here. Knockout rose bushes. I've had bug problems on them for a number of years and was told to spray with soap to keep the bugs off. Is Murphy's oil soap okay to use?
Well, it's going to depend on what concentration you're using and also what bug it is. So we go back to the culture of the rose. If you're having problems with a shrub for years and years, then I have to wonder if it's planted too deep or too high, or what your mulch level is, enough sun, enough water, you know, all of the things culturally, first of all, that would cause the shrub to be weaker, and then the insects move in to take her down. So you can try the Murphy's oil soap. I think it's a very small amount, though, like a teaspoon and a quart or something like that, and it only works by smothering the insect. So if you just spray it, hoping that it's going to do something for a few days, it doesn't work that way. You have to actually hit the insect, and then it smothers the insect. So I would back up and look at, like, why is the plant not healthy? Especially if it's a very old knockout rose, like if it's over 5 years old, sometimes they just get tired, and you just need to replace them with a fresh one.
Mm. We have another question from Mary Kay, who asked, what is the minimum soil temperature for planting seeds?
That varies with the seeds that you are planting. And as long as they're at room temperature, most of the time that's going to be enough. I know there's germination heat maps that can both speed germination and maybe cause heavier germination. I've never used those, and I've only done them right in regular soil when I'm starting my seeds on my kitchen table with the proper grow light. So I would be more concerned about grow light than I would be about the proper temperature, germination temperatures, unless you're doing funky seeds. You know, some more specialty seeds that need a little bit more attention in those directions. And your usual, your cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, and all that, like room temperature is always going to be enough for that.
What would you call funky seeds? I mean, is that actually a category at the garden center?
According to Erica Joe, it apparently is.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're starting things like butterfly weed or you know, more perennial-type things or more exotic, just more exotic-type seeds, because there are, you know, a bunch of different exotic seeds that, you know, maybe you're buying five seeds of an agave plant. You know, because agaves are more heat-loving plants, you might need a heat germination mat to mimic the temperatures that they would normally germinate at in their native habitat. Mm-hmm. Cactus seeds, things like that.
Let's take a phone call from Chris in Carlisle. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Because of some of the food shortages we've heard about, my wife and I have talked about starting a vegetable garden. I mean, just like you're talking about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes ago. But we started talking about it last week, and we found that we're late, to say it at least. Is there anything that can be done about that? Is there a, like, is there a guide to, oh, I should have planted this 6 weeks ago? I think you said cucumbers. Is there anything that we can do about that?
Yeah, there's actually, you're not that late. You're not that late. So right now, starting from seeds is going to be a little bit challenging because first you have to find somebody who's still got seeds left. So hopefully that would be a thing. And it's too late to start tomatoes. It's too late to start peppers. And too late to start, you know, some of the vegetables. And you can still do cucumbers, squash, pumpkins, watermelons, beans. All of those you could still start. We have tomato plants. We have pepper plants. We still have, I think, some onions, some kale. So you're pushing your edge, and you can absolutely still be successful. I have a whole list over here that tells you when you should start seeds and when you should put stuff out by seed into the garden. So you're welcome to scoot over here and get a copy of that, and that could be a good guide for you as a new gardener. But you're not too late. Go ahead and do it.
Thank you very much for your call.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
No, thank you.
We have a question here from Randall. It says, I have a bank that is covered in mulch, but it keeps washing away. Could you recommend a good ground cover that spreads quickly, looks nice, and is resistant to weed killer?
Well, the resistant to weed killer is the thing that you lost me right there. When you've got large areas and you do a ground cover over a large area, you know, seeds are opportunistic. So if they see bare areas, then they're, you know, we're going to say dandelion. We didn't even talk about dandelion, Joe.
Scott,
you're a dandelion seed. You're joyfully blasting through the air right now. You've got your little poof that's your airplane, and you're just looking for somewhere to land, right? So that you can grow. So on a large bank, you've got your dandelion seeds, your clover seeds, your cress seeds. You've got all these seeds like looking for some place to grow. They're just in the air like traveling. So depending on if you're sunny or shady makes a big difference for my answer. And also how large the bank is makes a difference for my answer. Your best bet there is to use preen or some sort of a seed preventer. They're called pre-emergence to limit the amount of weeds that will grow onto your bank. I like periwinkle a lot, which is also called vinca or myrtle. If you have soil, you know, so that's kind of a thing, and that would be a very low grow cover. It's super vigorous. It's very smothering to other things because it's tight, and that doesn't mean you're not going to get some weeds. The idea is to not let it get super weedy and figure out what to do about it. Like go and look every 2 weeks and address whatever you see so that you're always maintaining it at a part that you want to be weed-free.
You know, you mentioned dandelions for the first time, I thought for sure. And for those who have never tuned in to this program, haven't
how
heard.
How could that be?
Yeah. You know, Erica always brings something off the lawn or some kind of weed for me to eat. And one thing I wanted to mention to you that, and I don't know what it is this year because I've done nothing, but I have fewer dandelions in the yard this year. Is that weather related?
Well, I don't think. I've got tons of dandelions. You're not spraying weed killer, are you, Scott?
No, I just said I haven't done anything. But no, I've noticed that they only popped up. They popped up later, and there are fewer of them this year.
Well, for some on the idea of weed control again is weeds are opportunistic. So if your lawn is growing thicker or happier, and there's less bare spaces, then you're going to have fewer weeds, so-called weeds, that are going to be opportunists and come up in your lawn. So it may be that your lawn is just growing better. We had all that rain in autumn. My lawn, too, is, like, super thick this year. Very nice. Yeah, so it might have something to do with that.
Yeah, my lawnmower is actually having trouble keeping up this year, put it that way.
I'm mowing
more often than what I... And okay, that brings up a point. How often should you mow? Because I had a neighbor, now he moved away, but this guy used to mow 3 times a week. And I thought that was a little bit too much, but
I would say that's pretty excessive. There's a couple of things to consider there. First of all, if you're somebody who's using a lot of lawn fertilizer, of course your grass is going to grow faster, which is going to require you then to do a more frequent mowing. So if you use an organic fertilizer versus a chemical fertilizer, that's going to enrich your soil in a better way. That's not going to cause like that explosive growth. I'm mowing my lawn once a week, and then you mow it 3 inches high, which might sound like that's high, and it's not. But if you mow short, the grass blades can't photosynthesize, and so they're weaker, and then that's when the lawn weeds move in and start to brew out the grass. So at 3 inches high, you're shading the bare spots so the weeds kind of don't see them, and you're allowing the grass to be stronger and grow deeper roots by allowing photosynthesize. So 3 inches deep is where you need to be.
I have a mulching mower.
3 inches high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a mulching mower. Is that better than something that's like throwing it out the side or bagging it?
The mulching mower is nice. It chops it into a finer piece so that when it settles down into the soil, actually, it doesn't cause as much thatch as when you have one that just blows it out the side, You see people who blow it on the road, and you can see how long those blades are, which they shouldn't do, I'm just going to say, because you can wreck out a motorcycle when you're doing that, so you should be blowing your grass into the road. Anyways, that was a little side trip.
I like
mulch mowers. I actually bag mine because I use the grass clippings as mulch in my garden and mulch around my vegetable plants because I don't use chemicals in my lawn.
Let's take a phone call from Kelsey in Elizabethtown. Kelsey, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. My husband and I are doing a lot of gardening like everybody else right now, and we're looking for more native plants, and we're having a really hard time finding them at, like, our local greenhouses. So looking for maybe a source of, where to find these plants.
And you said you're in Elizabethtown.
Yes.
Yeah, well, we're here in Mechanicsburg, and we actually have quite a few native plants. So I'm not sure. I haven't been in Elizabethtown for quite a while, so I'm not sure what your sources are over there. And I'm pretty strong myself in my love of native plants. So we have things like sweetfire. We've got summer sweet. We've got native ferns. We've got Joe Pye weed. We've got lobelias. We've got native coral bells. We have all kinds of things over here, native hydrangeas. So, you might want to scoot over here. And, if you have a list of things you're looking for, you could certainly email that to us. And otherwise,
okay.
It would definitely be worth a drive over and to have a chat and see what you're after and what you're trying to achieve.
Okay, awesome. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
We have another call about native plants. Susan says, please mention the benefits to wildlife of using native plants in our gardens and not to use chemical herbicides or pesticides for the same reasons.
Oh, yeah. I'm super anti-chemical pesticides and insecticides, because you're killing our good things. You're killing the ladybugs and you're killing things, pollinators that you don't realize you're killing, like collateral damage type stuff. And again, like if you have a plant that's doing so poorly that you have to spray it, you should dig it up and get a plant that you don't have to spray. So that, hands down, like if you plant the plant right, If you notice if it was sunny or shady and you pick the right plant, you shouldn't be having issues unless it's a plant that has issues, because there's certainly lower class plants that are being sold that are going to get insects, you know, which is unfortunate, and it still happens. So that, and as far as the native plants and the native plant movement, which is so amazing, you know, our native flora and fauna recognize certain plants as food. So, you know, like when I mentioned the sweet spire and the summer sweet, you know, the number of pollinators I get on those two native plants is phenomenal. My red lobelia and the amount of hummingbirds I get on that one. And just bees, like there's so much goodness in the native plants that should be explored. And I still also believe, though, the right plant for the right place. So, you know, it's still culturally you need to be correct. You can't just, I mean, I don't see anybody planting poison ivy, and that's a native plant, right? So it's not just because it's a native plant.
Yeah, let me turn my microphone on. That would work a little bit better. you know, but something you mentioned, Erica, when, you know, I go right from native plants and the benefits of native plants to pollinators as well. You know, for the last decade, we've been talking about bees in particular, and how we have so few, fewer honeybees with the colony collapse and that kind of thing. But for those who are interested in planting plants, flowers that are pollinators, what would you recommend?
Oh, there's so many. Sunflowers actually is one of the biggest things that you can use for pollinators. Bee balm, summer phlox. It depends on also which bee, because honey bees don't necessarily like the same thing as other bees do. So that's a whole realm that would have to be explored. You know, mostly it's don't use the chemicals. But finally, there's a particular chemical that comes in a blue container that is systemic, and the systemic insecticide means that the plant absorbs it, and anything, any insect that eats on it for 30 days gets to die. And we're like, yahoo, you know, like I don't have to do any, I can just sprinkle some of this plant and I don't have to worry about it. Well, that also means the bees get to die because they're drinking the nectar and whatever the ladybugs that are trying to eat the aphids that are on your roses. So finally, that particular company did put on their label, warning, this kills bees. So I thought that was a pretty strong thing, because there's been a huge battle about that in our industry.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Yes, do stay tuned. At least the next 20 minutes. What do you mean all day? But the next 20 minutes for Erica Jo Schaefer, landscape designer and consultant with Black Landscape Center in Mechanicsburg. This is your opportunity to ask questions about that garden you planted this year, maybe for the first time, or those flowers that you've planted, maybe something that's not doing as well as what you would like, or you'd like to find a way for it to grow better. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go back to the phone now. John is in Lewisberry. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call. My mother has a dogwood tree that I planted about 2 years ago, and we staked it when we planted it, and I... Well, it's been doing okay, but the stakes have gotten loose, and the tree kind of leans over, and I was under the impression that you should leave the tree go and let it get strength on its own, but my mom's one neighbor says, oh no, it should be re-staked and held up, and they're worried about it, the neighbor's worried about it leaning over. We put a fence around it to keep the deer from eating it. And I was wondering what Erica's opinion would be or how to,
okay,
what to do with it.
So how big is the tree?
Oh, it's about six feet high.
6 feet high, okay. So first of all, any tree should root in fast enough that a tree should only need to be staked for 6 months. If it's staked longer than 6 months, the tree actually where you've got the, you know, the guy wire around the neck of the tree, like however, wherever you did that, the top of the tree moves in the wind and the bottom doesn't. And you actually start to cause a weak spot there because the whole tree should be able to move. So firstly, 6 months and the stakes come off. After that, however, like if it's been 2 years and that dogwood isn't rooted in yet, then there's something wrong with the root system. Like that should be rooted in well and standing on its own within 6 months. So I would suggest you pull the mulch back, actually pop the tree back out of the ground, make sure it wasn't planted too deep, because 2 inches too deep can actually kill some trees and certainly stress them out enough so that they don't root in the way that they could root in. So I would start there. I would pop the tree back out and you know, carefully, of course, you know, so you don't do lots of damage to the tree roots. But there's got to be something wrong with the roots, whether it was bought root-bound and you didn't pull the roots out so that they can get into the surrounding soil, or if it's planted too deep would be my first two things that I would look at.
Okay, I tried not to plant it too deep. I knew about that. And mm-hmm. I did, you know, unwind the roots or pull them apart, but... Hmm. I'll do that.
It's not heavy winds. There's not heavy winds there or anything like that that would keep causing it to shift.
Well, it's out in the open. There's a garage about 30 feet away from it, or 20 feet away from it. But you know, it's just out in an open area, and mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. It is sort of on a. It's in a suburban neighborhood, but it is open.
Yeah, no, that's
you know,
true.
And I guess
after 2 years, I think. That should definitely be situated. So there must be something wrong with the roots. And sometimes also we assume that when you buy a tree that it's at the right depth. And sometimes in the pot it's already 2 or 3 inches too deep. So you really should use one of those hand claw tools and excavate down before you even try to take it out of the ground and dig down until you find where the trunk stops and the roots start. And that should be at ground level. And then you'll have to stake it again now for 6 months. Right? But then once we go into winter, the stakes should come off.
Hey, John, thank you very much for your call. Good luck with that. Hey, you know, that always had a question about that, Erica. How close, you know, he used the dogwood as an example. I imagine that it depends on what breed of tree or what kind of tree you have. But how close to a structure should a dogwood tree be planted, or how far away from a structure should a dogwood tree be planted?
Well, and that is a great question. And so it depends on which dogwood is the first answer, because our native dogwoods can get about 15 feet wide, which means we're going to want to be 9 to 10 feet away from a structure. But the Chinese dogwoods, the Kusa dogwoods, which appreciate sun more, can get 20 to 25 feet wide. So now we've got to be 10 to maybe 15 feet away from a structure. So every tree has, genetically, has a known or at least a supposed known width that it's going to get at. So first of all, we see what that width is. Second of all, we look up and make sure there's no power lines above where you're about to plant the tree, you know, because we end up blaming the power line people for coming through with their chainsaws and scalping the tops of our trees, and we're the one that planted it there to start with, right? So it's both directions, away from a structure and look up so that you're not planting it underneath the power line.
We have a listener has two questions for you. Can you recommend some native ground covers that grow quickly? I have invasive, my phone keeps going off. I have invasive garlic mustard behind my shed in a mostly shaded area and want to kill that off first by smothering it with newspaper and black plastic and then replant with a native ground cover. I'll start with that question.
Yeah, depending on how heavy that garlic mustard is, you're doing a whole lot of extra work there. That actually pulls out pretty easily, and or you could use a stone rake or that hand claw tool I was talking about on a longer handle and actually just scruff it up real good to expose the roots, and you probably could take out 90% of them just by doing that. And then as far as a native ground cover, it's behind the shed, it sounds like it might be more shady because of the garlic mustard population there. So there actually is a native Pakistandra that I think is just beautiful. So I would highly recommend that you seek that out. There's
what
also some native Pakistandra.
Okay.
And then there also are some ferns, the lady ferns in particular, if the soil is moist enough, that will start to spore and cause their own colony there, which would be a little bit of a higher
ground cover that you could consider.
I love ferns. Okay.
I do too.
Is there a grass seed available that contains clover seed too? I read that clover is a nitrogen fixer and will help fertilize grass as well as help support pollinators. We're trying to avoid a monoculture lawn desert, but still want to fill in and maintain some grass pathways through our garden beds.
I love that question so much. Actually, the guy who invented Weed and Feed publicly apologized because it killed the clover. Back in the day, a good lawn was actually judged by how much clover it had in it because of that nitrogen fixation, which means it pulls nitrogen out of the air and puts it in the soil. So the answer is no, you cannot find a grass seed that already has clover seed in it. However, you can buy straight-up white clover seed and spread it through your lawn so that it can take. And thank you for doing that.
You know what I have to say? Now, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I have to say one of the memories that comes to mind is getting stung by bees on my bare feet when I was a kid.
Oh, honey. Watch where you're walking.
All right. Frank from New Freedom is on the line now. Frank, you're on the air.
Hello. My question is, what is the best time to split rhubarb?
Oh, rhubarb split. I would most likely wait until... Yeah, I would wait until early autumn. So I would probably be doing that at the end of August, somewhere in the Labor Day sort of situation, because you're going to do, when you bring that up, you're going to do root damage, and then you need to make sure that whatever tool you're using to split it is super, super sharp, because rhubarb roots can rot. If they're not, you know, if they don't have a nice clean cut. So I would say you can dig up what you want to split in that, again, that Labor Day situation. They like really rich soil, so add compost or cow manure back into the soil before you replant them. And then, as with everything else, make sure you don't plant it too deep because the crown will rot. But then we're going into cooler temperatures and more moisture after a hot summer, so they'll reestablish and be ready for you for next spring.
Okay, I was sort of thinking the fall.
Yep. It'll be a better time to do it. Yep. Are you enjoying your rhubarb? I've been making stewed rhubarb. Oh, it's so good.
Oh yes, we've had rhubarb pie. We make strawberries. It's a recipe we got from my grandmother. And about a week ago, we made rhubarb crisp.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Have you tried stewed rhubarb? That's another one you might want to try.
I used to do that. I just cook it up and I ate it for breakfast as a breakfast fruit.
Yep. I put it on my yogurt right now. It's so good.
Wow.
Yes.
You guys are in your own little world. Hey, thank you very much for your your own little rhubarb world there.
Yeah, my rhubarb.
let's see. Greg has a question here. It says, has a large patch of old English ivy under a dogwood tree that looks very sickly year after year, mostly in the shade. Can I fertilize or replace with another ground cover?
I would put both hands in the air to replace it with another ground cover. The English ivy is actually an invasive, which means that it's taking over in the woods and other places. I think Pennsylvania might have put it on the invasive weed list now. So it's another thing. Ivy is a plant. If it's not doing well for multiple years, then there's something culturally that it's not happy there. And or because ground covers get so nice and thick, they make fantastic habitat for voles and chipmunks who will eat on the roots, eat on the stem, and do great damage because they're protected underneath all of that foliage. So underneath the dogwood for a ground cover, it'll probably depend on how big the dogwood is. But that would be another one. You could use the periwinkle, depending on how big your ring is. You could use perennial geraniums that are more drought tolerant. That would be a more of a conversation about how big the ring is and how sunny or shady, because I don't know how far he's got this dogwood tree limbed up. You know, how much sun does the area actually get?
How do you get rid of the English ivy?
A rip and tear. Rip and tear. I read once they said they called it the mother root. Like, you have to find where this big root comes out of the ground where the ivy was planted originally. So you would cut all of what's there away and then watch to see where it starts to sprout again, and then actually have to go in with a spade and cut off the shoulder of the root to get it out of there.
Let's take a phone call from Tracy in Delville. Tracy, you're on the air. Hello, Tracy? Okay, maybe Tracy's not there. Let's take Diane from Lititz. Joe, I understand it's line two. Diane from Lititz, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for your hello.
Okay, can we got that me? Out of the way. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. What's your question? All right. Well, somehow I think we lost her. Let me see. Her question was she was looking for some low-maintenance plants. What would you recommend, Erica?
Well, low-maintenance is another thing. Like, do we want it for sun or for shade? So our questions are when somebody I can't wait for someone to tell me they want a high-maintenance garden. I'm going to have so much fun with that. So for a low-maintenance garden, we've got several things we need to, like, questions that need to be answered by the person requesting. Is, first of all, is this area sunny or shady? The second big question is, how big do you want the shrub to get? Like, what is the ultimate best perfect thing? Is it 3 by 3 foot? Is it 5 by 5 foot? Because most maintenance is caused by people having to trim because they didn't ask the question, how big do I want it to get in the spot? And then the sun or shade thing starts to fly into the culture, because if you put a sun plant in the shade, then it suffers. Then you end up spending money on chemicals whenever you didn't plant it in the spot. So it's a whole, like, it's a whole conversation of discovery, you know, of what you want. And then you come and bring that and say, hey, I'm looking for a shrub that gets 3 by 3 for a sunny area. And if it got yellow flowers on it, that would be great. I'd be like, oh, you want a St. John's wort, you know? So by having the right information and the needs, then you can come and get the right plant that will then be low maintenance.
Okay, let's see. I'm looking here for, we got a number of questions. I know we're not going to be able to get to all of them. Lori asks, can you please speak about native host plants for butterflies and moths, such as milkweed needed for monarchs?
Yeah, the milkweed is like, it is, it's kind of a craze even at this point. We, 2 or 3 years ago, man, we couldn't bring it in fast enough as everybody. And I was so happy about that people really got it and were, you know, looking for the ways to host our butterflies. It's kind of like the bluebirds, you know, the bluebirds almost died out too. And there was this grassroots effort to put up bluebird boxes everywhere. And that's why we still have bluebirds. You know, the chemicals, that's when they were spraying DDT and they were killing off so much, including the bluebirds. So as far as the monarchs, you know, and all of that, the butterfly weed, one of the things I don't think that everybody realizes is you plant that butterfly weed and that feeds the larva. So sometimes you'll see these caterpillars that are like eating the heck out of your butterfly weed and you're like, oh my God, and you go and spray them, right? Because you're like, all right, something's wrong here. And in fact, those are the monarch caterpillars that are feeding that turn into the monarchs. So when you do butterflies or like even fritillary butterflies, they love wild violets. You know, there's a very specific one that loves only wild violets. So if you're killing all the wild violets off in your garden, you're actually disrupting the cycle of that particular one. So there's the host plants that feed the caterpillars and there's the host plants that feed the butterflies. So it depends on which ones you're after. And there's so many beautiful ways to like explore that and get both things addressed. You know, dill and fennel are also, even though they're not native, the swallowtail caterpillars love them.
So, Erica, we only have about 30 seconds left. What's in your garden this year?
Oh my goodness. What is the question?
What's in your garden this year?
What's in my garden this year?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I'm actually myself too. I'm doing more vegetables than usual. And also I planted so many flowers this year. I mean, it's crazy how many flowers I planted. You know, as I'm home and I'm seeing what's precious to me because of the you know what virus that's going around. I think a lot of people, you know, you're nesting and you want what's around you to be beautiful. And so we're selling and so many flowers. People are planting so many flowers as well as the vegetables, because we're home and we're actually seeing our surroundings. And we're
hey, Erica,
I think it's beautiful.
I have to interrupt. Erica Jo Schaefer, landscape designer, consultant, Black Landscape Center of Mechanicsburg. Hey, thanks a lot. It's always a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. I'll drop off that dandelion salad when you've been.
Okay, we'll send questions to you, too.